What is Janet Yellen thinking? Remember, five words or less is the rule. How about this? Holy cow, now what happens? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdo. Good to have you here, everybody. It's Thursday today, the 17th of November. And how about a little Janet Yellen, huh? She spent some time on Capitol Hill today, did the Fed chair in front of the Joint Economic Committee. It's been a while since we've heard from her, and suffice it to say, there is no small amount of economic going on out there. But don't take it from me. Take it from the most powerful economist in the free world.
So, you know, from our point of view, we don't know what's going to happen. There's a great deal of uncertainty.
Best part of that cut is Janet Yellen saying, so, you know. Anyway, how long, Madam Chair, do you expect the uncertainty to last?
My guess is that uncertainty about these matters will last for some considerable time.
Okay, then. Also, the Fed thinks inflation is a-coming. As we have been telling you, rising bond yields and a strengthening dollar are signs the market is betting on Congress spending a whole lot of money in this coming new administration. It turns out the Fed thinks the exact same thing.
My interpretation would be that markets are anticipating that you will ultimately choose a fiscal package that involves a net expansionary stance of policy.
Fiscal policy, by the way, is the government's spending. Expansion is spending a lot. Also, by the by, it seems an interest rate hike is very much on the table for their meeting this coming December. And that gets us to housing in that way that capitalism works. The Mortgage Bankers Association reported yesterday that mortgage applications are down. Makes sense, given that rates, both in the market and in the mind of Janet Yellen, seem to be heading up. On the other hand, though, as economists like to say, there was news this morning that new home construction was up last month, as were permits for said construction. Pre-election numbers, yes, but a sign nonetheless that there is demand in a market that is still feeling the crisis and the housing bust. From the Marketplace Bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman gives us the lay of the housing landscape.
Let's start with those new home construction numbers. Now, keep in mind, this sector was slow to recover following the recession. Builders were too scared and scarred by the housing bust to break ground. Buyers were holding back, too, worried about their jobs and mediocre paychecks. And that resulted in an imbalance, says Susan Wachter at the Wharton School.
Supply not keeping up with demand.
Leading to a big spike in housing costs.
Dramatically increasing rents. Rents and prices are increasing in many markets across the U.S.
With new home construction picking up, there'll be more supply, helping to ease this affordability crunch. But now another wrench gets thrown in the works, rising mortgage rates.
That could chill the housing market and cause price increases to slow down.
Bad news for home builders just ramping up their business and homeowners thinking of selling. But don't go all negative yet, says Guy Sakala, publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance.
Interest rates alone aren't the primary factor when it comes to someone buying a house.
He says what'll keep driving buyers into the market is feeling safe and better off.
So to the extent the economy is humming along and people feel good about their jobs and their financial wealth, that bodes well.
Even if mortgage rates go to 5% next year, as he expects.
No question, there's still going to be some sticker shock when somebody goes out there and go, what do you mean the mortgage rate's 4.5%? I thought it was under 4. And they'll say, well, that was last year.
Yeah, record low mortgage rates. That could be so 2016. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, how about another major industry in this economy? With the collapse in crude prices the past couple of years, oil has seen quite the wave of consolidation. Producers, pipeline companies, companies that service oil fields all have gotten together. Refineries, though, have held out. For them, low oil prices, their raw material obviously, has meant higher profits. There are, though, some signs of movement. Today, Tesoro announced it's buying Western Refining for about $4 billion. Marketplace's Jed Kim looks at the economics of refining all that crude into gasoline.
Here's a little Econ 101. Business decisions are based on margins. Oil is no exception. Evie Adame teaches Econ at the University of Guelph in Ontario.
This production of oil costs 10 cents to make, and I can sell it for a dollar. I should make it. Now it costs 30 cents to make. I should make it. I keep doing that until the very last liter breaks even, and then I stop.
For refiners, production got a lot cheaper after fracking made U.S. crude a lot more available.
One of the big winners in that whole process was U.S. refiners, who had access during this period to what they called advantage crude.
Sandy Fielden is with Morningstar. He says the advantage was that for a few years, U.S. oil was a lot cheaper than the global price. That gave refineries, especially ones on the East Coast, bigger margins.
The cheaper price of the crude allowed them to absorb the higher freight cost of moving the crude by rail.
But things changed. Oil prices fell, and U.S. production with them. New pipelines created more competition for U.S. crude. And a ban on exporting U.S. oil was lifted. So now, U.S. prices are pretty much in lockstep with the global one. Kurt Barrow is VP of Oil Midstream and Downstream at IHS. For those East Coast refineries,
the imported crudes are now cheaper again.
But margins have shrunk for all refiners, so you're seeing deals like West Coast Tesoro buying Western Refining's operations in Texas, New Mexico, and Minnesota. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Sanctuary cities you've probably heard of, right? Cities that have decided not to cooperate with federal immigration authorities and from which President-elect Trump has promised to withhold federal funding. Now college students are asking their schools to become sanctuary campuses. Students at NYU, Stanford, and others have walked out this week demanding protection for undocumented students because Mr. Trump has said he plans to reverse an Obama administration policy allowing many of those students to stay in the country. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Between chants and speeches, 100 or so students, faculty, and staff at Johns Hopkins University took turns yesterday signing a petition. They want Hopkins to guarantee protection for immigrant students. 18-year-old freshman Carlos Silvera walked out of class to join the protest. He's a Miami-born Cuban-American, but knows undocumented students at other colleges.
I feel like if someone is really trying to better themselves, I don't know, I feel like all campuses should be like a place that welcomes that.
Donald Trump has indicated he plans to end the Obama administration's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, policy, which allows immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as kids to study and work here. 20-year-old Maria Jose Vides is a DACA student at Pomona College in Claremont, California. Her parents brought her from El Salvador when she was 10.
At this point, I've lived half my life in the United States, so I can't really say that I have a home back in El Salvador.
Pomona's president, David Oxtoby, estimates the small liberal arts college has between 50 and 60 undocumented students.
Our admissions policy is to treat students who graduate from high schools in the United States equally, regardless of immigration status.
He says the college is weighing its legal options. John Feary is legal policy analyst at the Center for Immigration Studies, which advocates for better immigration enforcement.
Any attempts to shield people from the law would be in violation of federal law. And I think that these campuses would be a little bit hesitant to do such a thing.
But federal student privacy law shields colleges from sharing student records, says Maria Blanco. She's executive director of the University of California Undocumented Student Legal Services Center. And she says campus police are not required to enforce immigration law. Blanco says for students, the sanctuary movement is partly symbolic.
I think that a lot of what they need is to know that there are institutions that don't want to sort of kick them to the curb, you know?
The UC system has thousands of undocumented students. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Mostly green on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. One thing politicians and voters agree on pretty consistently, and across party lines, too, is that our infrastructure needs to be repaired. Everything from bridges and roads to water lines and the electrical grid. President-elect Trump has a proposal that could mean $1 trillion get spent to fix things up. Good news, one would imagine, for builders and construction companies. Fits right in with our series that we're calling The Big Promise, how all those sweeping campaign pledges that Mr. Trump made might actually turn out. Marketplace's Andy Euler has one infrastructure piece of it.
It was one of the first things President-elect Trump said in a victory speech a couple of Tuesdays ago.
We are going to fix our inner cities. and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure.
Nobody that drives on roads in this country or reads about failed railroad tracks needs convincing. But the plan the president-elect laid out during his campaign is one that would get most, if not all, of the money to build this new infrastructure from private investment. Toll roads are an easy one. If you drive on the road, you pay a fee. It's a little more complicated to figure out how a company is going to get a return on investment from replacing the lines that deliver water to the homes in a city, or the company that produces the asphalt to pave the roads.
What the president-elect is proposing is the use of a lot of public-private partnerships. How that actually plays out, we don't know.
Carter Ross is a spokesperson for the National Asphalt Pavement Association.
Congress has talked about dealing with the Highway Trust Fund's structural deficit as part of tax reform, but we have no idea what tax reform is going to look like. So I think there are a lot of question marks, and what's clear is that the need is out there.
You don't have to think back too long to remember President Obama telling us about 10,000 infrastructure projects that had been funded through a stimulus bill passed during his first term. He said those shovel-ready projects would create thousands of jobs. Just a year later, he admitted,
shovel-ready was not as shovel-ready as we expected.
And even those projects that are shovel-ready, repaving roads, repairing bridges, and rebuilding airport terminals, aren't going to necessarily increase American productivity. Randall Eberts is president of the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research.
It's going to give us a boom in terms of jobs, but with low unemployment rate now, we're going to be taking jobs away from some other sector to employ them in the infrastructure sector.
And then there's the possibility that we're investing a bunch of time and money in building things in a time where self-driving cars are being tested and the way we produce electricity is changing. Steve Swartz is a partner in McKinsey & Company's Center for Business and Environment.
There is a tremendous fear that decisions getting made now on infrastructure are locking us into a pathway. I think people are worried about the lock-in on the energy sector in particular that comes from those types of long-lived investments.
But it sounds like despite this fear, many of these infrastructure projects are likely to get green-lit, and many building companies are going to get contracts. Who's going to foot the initial bill for the investment and what projects are going to take priority in the new administration are just a few of the details the Trump team has to work out. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We've been checking in the past week or so with our regulars, people running companies in this economy. Today, Austin Golding, the co-owner of Golding Barge Lines, are in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Austin, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, great to talk to you.
Well, what is the talk down there in Vicksburg about this election and where y'all see things going?
Well, I think that obviously Mississippi being deep in Trump country down here, there's a lot of optimism. But I think there is also a lot of uncertainty. I think that is also the case here as it is much around the country. People don't know what to expect. They voted in change, and now they're wanting to see what the fallout of that change, if they happen to be the beneficiary of that or not.
What do you think people are looking for change-wise? Is it less regulation? Is it easing up on oil and gas? And that's, you know, a large part of what you guys carry in your barges. I mean, what kind of change?
Well, I think from a regulatory standpoint, we've done a really good job working with our regulators to have a good working relationship. So we're an industry that kind of is unique in that perspective. What we do get excited about is this talk about an infrastructure bill and investment into our infrastructure. Couple that with the fact that we're trying to have a renaissance in how we trade with the world. There is no better facilitator for our trade on the worldwide market than our marine ports and infrastructure. So if we're going to invest in that, it couples right with his promise to push our trade into a new era.
So that's a real thing for you, this idea that he wants to have an infrastructure bill that is going to really help things out at the actual, like, sort of working economy level.
Well, I can tell you that personally I hold a healthy skepticism that you can bring 535 people together in Congress to actually make that happen in the first 100 days. But why not be optimistic? We're a tiny fraction of what he's talking about. We're just looking to be thrown in. We're looking to be thrown into the pot with the rest of the ingredients.
There was a whole big, come on, man, in that answer, right? Give me a break.
Well, you know, I mean, we really aren't the big ask here. And I think the return on investment you get in our marine infrastructure, it would reflect a huge impact on, especially our grain exports in this country. They facilitating the grain that we harvest to getting to the markets around the world easier and quicker, that pairs with this trade renaissance that we've been sold. So I'm optimistic that it can come together under that premise.
What does it look like for you, marine infrastructure? Is it dredging? Is it locks and canals? I mean, get down to the nitty-gritty.
Well, I think that dredging has been actually pretty taken care of. I'm talking about locks and dams more than anything, Kai. Our locks and dams in this country were built the last time this country invested in infrastructure, and I think the people that built them were planning on the next generation doing the exact same thing. Well, that generation didn't. Not only am I talking about river industry, I'm talking about a benefit to recreation, to hydroelectric power, to flood prevention, to water supply. It's more than just industry that would benefit from this investment.
You've talked a couple of times in the last, 3 minutes that we've been on the phone here about how you've been promised stuff and how you got sold on the Trump economic plan. How confident are you that he can deliver on this big promise that he has made?
Well, I think that the American people have spoken, and I believe that the people that have the confidence have held him accountable through their vote.
Did you vote for him?
I did vote for him. I found myself huddled around the infrastructure promises and the economy. And also, I think that the marine industry is one of the greenest industries there is in this country. And if it wasn't embraced by a Democratic presidential candidate, then I couldn't support that candidate, being that I didn't think my priorities, which should be her priorities, were a priority.
Austin Golding, co-owner of the Golding Barge Lines out of Vicksburg, Mississippi. We talk to him every now and then. We'll call you up again in a couple of months. We'll talk, all right?
All our best. Hey, hanging in there and keep your fingers crossed.
All right, man. Be good. Coming up,
I've seen firsthand the devastation that financial crises can inflict on the economy. We're still recovering.
Why 2008 seems like only yesterday. But first, let's do the numbers. About 2008 in the markets, that's for sure. The Dow Industrial's up 35 points today, about 0.2%, 18,903. The NASDAQ up 39 points, 0.75%, 53.33. The S&P 500 added 10 points, about 0.4%, 21.87. Drill down earlier on the refinery business. In that world today, the news of Tesoro buying Western Refining Holdings. Told you about that. Western Refining up 23%. Tesoro revved 0.9%. Hammered a bit on that big uptick in housing starts. Mitchell Hartman did. Housing and real estate company Meritage Homes added 2.6% today. Beazer Homes rose 1.25%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.29%. Look at that. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Neel Kashkari is a name you might recognize. He was one of the people at the Treasury Department back in 2008, doing his best to keep the economy, both this one and the global one, from going down the drain. Kashkari ran the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the big bailout program. He has now gone on to become the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, but he has not forgotten whence he came. Kashkari has spent the past 10 months or so working on a plan that he says would end the idea of too big to fail by making the big banks keep more cash on hand so that there is less risk to the rest of us if something goes wrong. Neel Kashkari, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
We were talking once this interview got set up. We were talking around the offices, and somebody, I forget who, said, I wonder if he's still traumatized from the whole TARP thing and his experience during the financial crisis. What do you think?
You know, it's a fair question. The financial crisis was traumatic for a lot of people. I was at Treasury, one of the first responders, trying to keep the U.S. economy from collapsing. That's what's motivating this. I don't want anyone in the U.S. country, the people, to ever face this again. We need to address too big to fail so that we don't repeat the same mistakes that we made last time.
There are a whole bunch of laws rolled out, as you well know, designed to save us from a catastrophic financial crisis again. Dodd-Frank and the designation of systemically important financial institutions. Do I hear you saying that we haven't done it yet? All that Sturm und Drang from Dodd-Frank and all the rest was for nothing?
We haven't done it yet. It's been a step in the right direction. You know, we analyzed the history of financial crises around the world using data from the International Monetary Fund. And our analysis says that before the crisis, there was an 84% chance of having that type of a crisis in the next century. Hmm. That risk has now been reduced to 67%. So it's progress. But in my book, 67% is still way too high.
Yeah. You guys get it to something under 10, isn't it? I read the plan.
That's right. We get it to just under 10% by making the banks issue a lot more capital, a lot more buffer against bad things from happening in the future.
You know, one of the reasons that it's interesting that it's you who's doing this as the president of the Minneapolis Fed is that you are a Republican. You have been in the past. You ran for governor in California as a Republican. You are not a big regulations guy.
That's correct. I am a Republican. I worked for President Bush in the Bush administration. But I've seen firsthand the devastation that financial crises can inflict on the economy. We're still recovering, right? When I look at the country today, we're divided as a country. There's a lot of anger out there. I think a lot of that started with the financial crisis. So we're still paying the toll for those mistakes. Financial crises are so expensive, so costly for Main Street that we can afford to spend a little bit of money in terms of making the bank safer to avoid those terrible outcomes.
If you carry the day, what are the next steps? Is it going to be a Fed rule? Is it going to be a law? What do you want to do?
We think we need new legislation. We need Congress to weigh in and say, you know what, let's address too big to fail once and for all, and then let's relax regulations on the community banks that are not systemically risky. And to me, it's appropriate for Congress to make that decision because ultimately the American people need to decide how much safety do they want in the financial system and what price are they willing to pay for that safety. Safety isn't free.
You know, I'm sure that President Trump comes into office with a platform that is largely going against a regulatory framework, right? He wants to loosen regulations on this economy.
Well, I've heard him say that, but I've also heard him say that the biggest banks were, you know, part of the crisis and that we need to make sure that that doesn't happen again. So I'm not sure yet where the new administration is going to be. We're putting a credible plan forward so that Congress or the administration can take it forward if they choose to.
Neil Kashkari is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, Minnesota. Neil, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
We do an every now and then series on this program about women who were trailblazers in their professions. Today, it's medicine. Here's author Sam Maggs.
Elizabeth and Emily Blackwell were two sisters in the 19th century, both of whom received degrees in medicine, incredibly rare for the time. The two of them were barely able to get medical degrees because schools were so convinced that women were either not smart enough to get medical degrees or didn't have the temperament. Emily Blackwell, when she started to attend school in Geneva, New York, the town thought that there would be an outbreak of contagious insanity because she must have been insane, which was the impetus for them to start their own medical school just for women in New York City. And by the turn of the century, they had trained over 400 women doctors together. Elizabeth eventually moved on from the school. Emily stayed on as dean for many, many years, but eventually decided to shut down their school when Cornell nearby started taking male and female students because she really wanted to push non-gendered education and thought that was very important. In this process, she helped raise over $50,000 for Harvard Medical School and was about to give it to Harvard on the condition that Harvard start accepting female students, and officials at Harvard turned it down. The fact that they were able to overcome those odds just to get medical degrees and then used that to share their knowledge and make it easier for all of the women who came after them is a huge accomplishment for the Blackwells. And I think it's a real travesty that they're not household names.
Sam Maggs is the author and illustrator of the book Wonder Women, 25 Innovators, Inventors, and Trailblazers Who Changed History. This final note on the way out today, which comes with a reminder that the soon-to-be president of the United States more than once during his campaign accused the sitting chair of the Federal Reserve of playing politics with interest rates in order to get Hillary Clinton elected. Dr. Yellen was asked during her testimony today if she's going to quit.
I was confirmed by the Senate to a four-year term, which ends at the end of January of 2018, and it is fully my intention to serve out that term.
All right, we got to go. The Dow up 35 points today, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 39 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 10 to the good, 0.4%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.